Hey guys, we know you're listening to us all across the country.
And there's a pretty good chance that the town you live in is doing some soul searching about gun violence.
That's definitely happening in St. Louis, where we live and produce this show.
Hey guys, it's me, Tim.
And me, Camille.
So last winter, we did a show about how many places are trying a new approach to fighting violence by treating it like a public health issue.
And if you listened to that show, you may remember that we dropped a hint that we weren't done with the topic.
And if you didn't catch it, you should stop right now and go back and listen to it. It's available on iTunes or our website, welivehere.show. Because today, we're again talking about gun violence.
And there's a good reason why. Last year, 2015, the city of St. Louis saw 188 homicides, the deadliest year in two decades. Renee Whitfield's son was one of the victims.
Every day it just hurts, you know, and I think I spoke to someone just the other day and said that people that are committing these acts out here don't even realize what they're doing. You know, they don't understand that you're destroying lives, destroying families because of your ignorance.
On today's episode, we try to cut through some of that ignorance.
Our colleagues Jory Buscarin and Rachel Lippman give us a 360-degree view of gun violence. We're going to share some of the stories they produced.
Because from a family to a neighborhood and beyond, as you follow the wake of each homicide, the ripples get wider and wider.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
A project exploring
race,
class,
power,
poverty,
systems and the people they touch.
I'm Tim Lloyd.
And I'm Camille Stanley. And from St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here.
So when Camille and I were putting together this episode, the first thing we did was ask Jory Buscarin.
That's our health reporter.
Right. We asked Jory if there's a single place that represents the toll that all of these homicides can take on the entire community.
Yeah, she thought about it for a while and then decided to take us here.
So we're here at Barrett Brothers Park. It's in the Wells Goodfellow neighborhood. And there's a bike path around the edge. So if you look, there are about 40 sapling trees. They were planted last summer by a bunch of anti-violence groups and mothers groups. And one of those, that one right over there, there's like a stuffed monkey in it. It's in honor of Rashad Farmer.
Rashad Farmer was one of last summer's murder victims. He was shot and killed in July, a couple blocks from this park.
His mother, Renee, is the woman you heard from at the beginning of the show.
And Dury spent a lot of time with the family, sometimes here at the park, other times at Renee's home in North St. Louis County.
You walk into her living room and it's full of memorabilia. She was wearing a shirt that said Rest in Heaven. There's a cardboard, life-size cardboard cut out of him that stands behind the couch. And you could just, it was so clear how devastating his loss has been for this family.
I had my son at 19. It was like we were best friends, you know, because we grew up together. With him being gone now, it's just like, it feels like a whole part of me is just gone.
Rashad Farmer was 23 years old, with an easy smile and dreadlocks down past his shoulders. When his little brother Truly was born 4 years ago, Rashad helped take care of him. He and his girlfriend were expecting a child of their own in just a few months, and the couple had just found a house where they could move in together. They had stopped at his girlfriend's grandmother's home in North St. Louis, and he stayed in the car while she went inside.
So I got a phone call from his girlfriend, and all I heard her was just screaming in the phone, and she's like, "Miss Renee, Rashad's been shot," and I was like, "What?"
Whitfield called every relative she knew in North City, jumped into the car, and started driving, not knowing what she would find.
But when I got there, the first face I seen was my sister, and she said, "He's gone." And it was just like, part of me just left my body. And I kept wanting to go and see him and go to him and hold him, and they wouldn't let me do it.
Whitfield remembers falling to the ground, screaming.
Felt like I failed him, like I wasn't there to protect him.
But Farmer's death is also unique. His uncle, Jeffrey Boyd, serves as alderman for the ward where he died.
it was just really difficult for me to deal with, and I was extremely frustrated.
I met Alderman Boyd in his office at City Hall. He and his wife grew up in Wells Goodfellow and moved back in the 90s because they wanted to help make the neighborhood a better place.
You know, you question yourself. You work so hard for the community. You know, you want to be this do-gooder, and then it happens to you and your family. But of course, it certainly speaks to the fact that no one's immune. You could be the best advocate, you know, for put down the pistols and, you know, against gun violence, and then it could just happened to you.
On Mondays, Whitfield buys a dozen red balloons and drives to Barrett Brothers Park, just a few blocks from where Rashad was shot.
Come over this way, Trudy.
As Whitfield passes balloons out to family members, they say a quick message and release them, even 4-year-old Trudy, Rashad's younger brother.
Whenever you're ready.
Love you, Rashad.
The St. Louis neighborhood where Rashad Farmer was murdered is called Wells Goodfellow. Used to be a place where people came to buy homes and raise families. The nearby Chevy plant, which is now closed, provided jobs and a sense of pride.
But last year, Wells Goodfellow was one of 3 neighborhoods in the city of St. Louis that saw more than a dozen homicides. Dury drove us around.
Okay, so right about now we're now in Wells Goodfellow. So it's Union and Martin Luther King. A few decades ago, there were a bunch of stores here. This was really a main commercial district. And I mean, there's still stuff going on.
But clearly not as much.
Yeah. Yeah, you see, I mean, at least in this neighborhood, about 1 in 3 buildings is vacant. And I mean, like that one, it looks like there was a fire. See that one with the, there's like a tree growing through it.
As we drive through the neighborhood, which only takes a few minutes, Dury reminded us that Wells Goodfellow is only about a mile square.
You realize pretty quickly that once you know one resident, they know everyone. And so it just kind of, everyone that I talked to would be like, oh, there are 5 more people you have to interview, and they're all my friends, and we all grew up together. And that was really cool. It's, you definitely realize how connected people feel to each other and to this place.
So what did people say when you asked them about what it was like last year with all these murders, if everybody knows each other?
Mm-hmm. It was hard. I mean, everyone knows someone who's, you know, witnessed a shooting or knows someone who is a victim or knows someone who's been a perpetrator. It's really tough.
As Dury was out reporting, she met Siobhan Phillips. She lives around here.
A couple of years ago, Siobhan was walking home with her 6-year-old daughter when a woman they knew, Juliet Cleveland Davis, was hit by a stray bullet. It was the first time Siobhan had witnessed the shooting.
When she got shot, she was with her grandkids. They was just coming from the store. I told my baby to run back. So when I seen her fall, I ran to her rescue, tried to help save her. She was breathing and still, but
Juliet didn't make it.
She was a pillar of the neighborhood, too. Outgoing, like if she see like the bump pop truck, she will buy all the kids bump pops off the truck.
That was 2014. Phillips, who lives in Wells Goodfellow with her 2 daughters, says gun violence changes things. She doesn't let her youngest walk home from school alone, and they do not leave the house at night.
But I don't live in fear. I don't live in fear, cause it's up to God to choose who He's gonna take.
Almost 6,000 people live here, in an area just over a mile square. The recession hit hard. 1 in 3 homes are vacant, according to the last census. Driving through, you'll see a few buildings with the scorch marks of a fire left to collapse. Phillips says she's raising her family here because she grew up here and wants to help make it a better place. She has dreams of opening a boutique on Martin Luther King Drive. A lot of the people she grew up with feel the same way, like Tamron Coleman, who decided to start a support group for women who have lost loved ones.
My god sister had lost her daughter, and she would call wee hours of the night through the day. And I was like, I gotta do something. I just kept telling her, I'm gonna do something for you. But I just didn't know what at the time.
Coleman calls the group Helping Unite Grieving Sisters, HUGS. About half of her members have buried a child because of gun violence. We chatted on the red vinyl seats of a nightclub that lets her use their space for her organization's special events. Coleman says that for a time, her own kids lived pretty dangerously.
Like, my children now are incarcerated. That is probably the best thing that could have happened for them. I couldn't reach them. they not hearing me, so maybe I could reach somebody else's. If you could save one, you've done a lot.
Coleman says the violence in Wells Goodfellow has divided the community she's always known. Kids can't play outside, elderly people can't sit on their front porches. Most businesses have moved out.
If you ride around the Wells Goodfellow neighborhood, it's dead. There's no life. It's all been sucked out.
But there is life.
Hello, hello, hello.
We walk across the street, and Coleman introduces me to Sam Morgan, the owner of the Westside Barbershop. Morgan remembers how in the 80s, boys in the neighborhood would bring their report cards into the shop, and his father would give them a dollar when they earned an A.
I saw some of these boys drop out of school to sell drugs. This was 79 and 80. I saw the whole neighborhood change because of drugs and guns.
Gun violence is something he sees himself talking about often with clients in the chair, but still, nothing changes.
You know, every time something happens, gun issues pop up for about 2 weeks. Then it's gone. Nobody care. Nobody really care, because if we cared, we'd get these guns off the street.
So let's pick things back up with Dury's reporting partner, Rachel Lipman.
Hey, Rachel, how's it going?
Hey, Tim, it's going well.
So, Rachel, you cover the criminal justice system here at St. Louis Public Radio, but you don't start the rest of this story at the police station or the courthouse. Where are we going?
We are going to the emergency room of St. Louis University Hospital. When Dury and I kind of came up with this reporting project, we wanted to focus on what gets left behind after a homicide, what happens in a wake of a homicide. And we wanted to talk to the obvious people like the police and the victims' families, but we also wanted to tell the story of the people who are treating these gunshot wound victims, who are trying their best to keep them from becoming another homicide statistic.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Why don't we just get out of the way and let you tell the rest of it?
From a practical standpoint, the healthcare infrastructure can handle the volume of patients it sees, but the violence takes a toll on those who provide that care. 15 or more people, doctors, nurses, x-ray techs, and social workers will be waiting when the most seriously wounded patients arrive at one of the region's two major trauma centers. That moment isn't stressful, says Lori Byrne. She's the chief of emergency medicine at St. Louis University Hospital. Everyone in that moment knows the jobs they have to do.
Intubate or secure the patient's airway, get blood going, making sure we have the ability to crack their chest open, and anticipating, you know, if they need to go to the operating room.
From a medical standpoint, Byrne says gunshots are easy. You're trying to find the hole and figure out what the bullet damaged. But when a gunshot wound is part of a crime, that's when things get a little more complicated.
You just wonder on certain cases how many more that evening you're going to get, because then, you know, they go out to, someone else goes out to, you know, avenge that.
And Byrne says it continues what can be a deeply frustrating cycle.
They come and they expect us to, you know, take care of things, when then they, again, go back out and do the same thing and, you know, putting themselves at risk.
I've never worked in a harder ED.
That's Helen Sancool. She started working in emergency medicine in 1973. She's now the director of nursing for emergency, trauma, and disaster at SLU, and she says she's watched the weapons get more powerful and her victims get younger.
You're not really tough. You have to prepare yourself and you have to focus on the patient. And when, you know, they said there's no crying in baseball, there's really no crying in emergency nursing while you're resuscitating a patient.
That emotional grind takes its toll. Mental health support is available, but Sancool says the resources aren't used as much as they should be. But she says even with all that stress and pressure, you can't let patients become a number.
In my, you know, 43 years, never once saw a gunshot wound that was the same. And that's the way they need to look at every patient. It's not just another gunshot wound, but every patient's an individual.
And even if they are a victim of violence, Sancool says, the medical community is not judge and jury. You have to treat everyone the same, regardless. That same topic came up with an ambulance crew I met up with at SLU Hospital. Emergency medical technician Nick Keener and paramedic Lori Ledbetter.
You know, they're calling us for us to fix, you know, show up to the scene and fix them. I guess is,
yeah, it doesn't matter. I mean, this person, you know, that you transport could be someone who was involved in a robbery and just shot someone's grandma. Or they could be someone who was, you know, at a bank and got hit in crossfire and they're a completely innocent person. Doesn't matter, and we don't know at the time.
Figuring out guilt or innocence is the job of the criminal justice system.
The St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department opened 188 homicide investigations last year. Lieutenant John Green has spent more than 25 years on the force.
And he told Rachel that all the violence feels like an endless cycle.
Sometimes it's the same witnesses or participants in some of the murders. Different reason. It's just the neighborhood they're involved in, the lifestyle they lead.
Green has 27 homicide detectives under his command. They made arrests in just 63 of those 188 cases last year. And Green says they could have made a lot more.
Well, a lot of them, we know who did it. Or we suspect the person. We just can't prove it. Witnesses are very, that's what you need. That's what you need to make a case. I mean, you see it on TV, you get a guy caught with a smoking gun. You need more than that. You need somebody who can put the gun, who saw the incident, saw him shoot, or overheard him talking about it.
That's a frustration shared by Mary Pat Carl, the lead homicide prosecutor in the city of St. Louis.
The number one reason we can't issue a homicide is lack of witness participation.
Over the last 5 years, prosecutors have charged an average of 57 people with murder a year. But there's no statute of limitations, so Green can arrest someone 10 years later, and if it's supported by the evidence, Carl will charge them. But there are two sides to every homicide case. The accused have a right to defend themselves and to argue that they didn't do it. This brings us to Mike Mann, a public defender in St. Louis.
You know, I don't want to be ineffective, and I want to win, and I want to do the best that I can do.
And that involves more than just poking holes in what the prosecutor says.
You kind of have to get the police reports, filter it, read between the lines, see what is there, see what might not be there. And then on top of all of that, you've got to do your own independent investigation, which that can be, the client says, you know, I was at Walmart, you know, out in Richmond Heights. If you go look, there will be a video. So that's like a totally independent investigation that we do.
Defense attorneys tell me they run into the same problems as prosecutors. Witnesses who support their client's story will usually talk to them. But those who are being called to testify for the state, they're a little more reluctant, and some just won't talk to anyone. Prosecutors do pretty well when a case goes to trial. In 2015, for example, juries found the defendant guilty in 9 of the 11 murder trials. Homicide prosecutor Mary Pat Carl says a guilty verdict brings a brief moment of relief.
I've never felt a moment, God, especially in a homicide case, that is ever a moment of celebration. There's a life still gone and a life that's now facing a life in prison.
Lieutenant John Green, the homicide commander, doesn't track the ins and outs of every case he's investigated, but they do follow him long after the courtroom drama concludes.
I didn't think that I would be tied to all these cases for so long. You know, even after the murder suspect's been caught, put away, and found guilty, I still get calls. I still see them, you know, in grocery stores, families in grocery stores, or some cases that we lost. That, you know, I talk to the families, and that's totally, that's one of the things that how it affects the detectives, that the cases stay with them.
You can't just write a report and move on, he says. You are a family's conduit to the loved one they lost.
So, Rachel, we know that last year there was a big spike in homicides, but what about 2016? What's been going on this year?
We're right about where we were last year. As of late May, there'd been 66 homicides. Vast majority of the victims were black males between the ages of 20 and 40. More than half of them happened in North St. Louis, and the vast majority of the homicides were committed with guns.
And the city's response to this rising number of homicides is something called the PEER plan, right?
Yeah, so PEER stands for Prevention, Intervention, Enforcement, and Reentry. And you see similar things like this happening all over the country.
Sure.
But basically here in St. Louis, what it looks like is 15 of the most troubled neighborhoods have been targeted with resources like job training, additional police, additional trash pickup, just things that help address all of the causes of crime.
And so this would include the Wells Goodfellow neighborhood where we spent part of our show earlier?
That's right.
So what's been happening with this plan, though?
So it's only about 5 months old, and nothing that they're trying to address within this plan is going to happen within 5 months. But there are a lot of people who say it's just uncoordinated. They haven't seen the resources they were promised. They don't know what's supposed to be happening with some of these resources that are there. And while they acknowledge that it will take time, they just feel like they don't have enough information about what's supposed to be happening, or they don't feel like they're getting the resources they think their neighborhoods need.
So not everybody's impressed with this?
Not at all.
All right, Rachel, we know you're going to keep following this story, and so is Dury. And if you want to follow their reporting, you can find it at stlpublicradio.org. Thanks, Rachel.
Thanks, Tim.
So if you like today's episode and you're a fan of the podcast but you haven't become a subscriber yet, you should fix that. So go to iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, really wherever it is you're getting your podcast these days, and follow us.
Right, and if you do happen to be listening to us on iTunes, if you don't mind, look down and give us one of those 5-star reviews. That really helps out.
It does.
Yeah, and if you also happen to be listening to us on NPR One, click the interesting button or click the share button and share it with your friends.
Speaking of sharing, we're on Twitter, so follow us at WeLiveHereSTL. And if you want a little bit more content, we've got photos and stories and graphics at our website, WeLiveHere.show.
And We Live Here is produced by me, Tim Lloyd.
And me, Camille Stanley.
Shula Newman is our editor.
And Cassie Morgan composed our theme music.
And from St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.